Chairman. I am Ken Vines. I'm the insurance commissioner for the state of Wyoming, and I'm also the director of the Wyoming Department of Insurance. I have with me today Peter Greff and Brenda Patch from my office. They are both life and health insurance standards consultants in my department. The reason I brought them in was in case there are any substantive questions about either the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool, which Peter is responsible for overseeing in our department, or the small employer reinsurance pool, which Brenda is responsible for overseeing in our department. As far as the budget, I'll be talking about that. The Wyoming Department of Insurance is a small department. There are only 24 staff, including me, so I'm the budget guy, and I do the budget working with my fiscal staff, so I'll be talking about that. Mr. Chairman, basically the Wyoming Department of Insurance oversees four budget divisions through the department. The first one is the administration of the department, and that's the actual administrative budget of the insurance department. The second one is the Board of Insurance Agents Examiners, which is a small board, six people or so, that's appointed by the governor, and their purpose is to advise the department on examination and testing of agents for licensing. They have a tiny little budget that's under the new budget is only about $12,000, so very small budget. The third division is the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool, which is the separate entity that provides health insurance coverage to Wyoming citizens who otherwise would not be able to get health insurance in the private market. And then the fourth one is the Small Employer Health Reinsurance Program, which is a reinsurance program that allows insurers in the small group market to reinsure high-risk individuals or groups into the reinsurance pool, the idea being that that takes them out of the rating factors in the small employer market, so that it helps mediate the rates that are charged in the small group market. So, Mr. Chairman, the administration budget I'll talk about briefly for the department. The first thing I would say is we are a self-funded agency. In other words, we use no general funds to operate the Wyoming Department of Insurance. The way we're funded is every insurance company that is licensed in the state of Wyoming, and there's about 1,100 of those companies, are assessed for the department budget on an annual basis. So, for example, the current year, I think the assessment was about $2,450 per insurance company licensed in the state of Wyoming, and if you multiply that by 1,100 companies, that basically gets us half of our budget. We assess those companies on an annual basis, so we do it twice during a biennium. So the department has basically no general fund money to operate the department. I would also note that all the money we collect, either through licensing fees, fines, penalties, and also the premium taxes that are charged to insurance companies that we collect, that all goes into the general fund for use for general government. The insurance department doesn't receive any of that money, and as I said, our sole funding is through the assessment.
Yeah, Ken, we had some discussion when the retirement system was here, and I think it was noted that the volunteer fireman's retirement is funded through insurance premiums, and the emergency medical team or emergency medical technicians got into the system a few years ago, and they don't have any funding. I don't know how much you're putting over to the general fund. that was, you know, maybe an avenue to give them a revenue stream or an income stream. What have you got out there as far as what goes to the general funds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, the voluntary fireman's fund retirement is funded through, and I don't have that in my head exactly how that formula works, but it is funded through the department through certain amount of the premium taxes that are transferred into that fund. I know a couple years ago there was a discussion to add other groups into that funding, and my recollection is that never happened.
Right, it didn't. Yeah.
And, you know, I would just tell you, just in general, as a gross amount, we collect somewhere around $20 million. I shouldn't say collect. We assess about $20 million in premium taxes a year. However, probably only about $10 million of that actually goes to the general fund, because there are premium tax credits that help support a couple of these programs I talked about, like the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool and the Small Employer Reinsurance Program, because insurers are assessed to support those programs, and in return they get a premium tax credit. So even though we have a gross amount of 20, we're probably putting about 10 in right now.
Mr. Chairman, I guess could you do a little bit of research to find out whether there's any prohibitions about going into that EMT program, whether it might be that we're just precluded from them because they're not medical enough for health insurance or something like that. I don't know. Yeah.
Folks, this is important. For all practical purposes, this is a tax. It's just like any other. It's a tax on the privilege to do business, and we collect the tax. And when you look at your goldenrod and you see the revenues that are forecasted in, it forecasts all tax revenue, including the approximate $10 million that was just alluded to by Mr. Vines. And if you want to intercept the tax before it gets to the general fund, the legislature has the capacity to do it, but then you lower the revenues to the general fund. And oftentimes, now what happens is that if you watch the goldenrod, when those interceptions take place, the minute it's intercepted as an expenditure because you've captured it, there should be a corresponding reduction to your general fund revenues on that day. Now, what happens oftentimes, and you'll see, is that bills come in, and they, in order to prevent that profile from taking place, they implement the interception in the year after the biennium starts, so it looks like it's a net zero, so it doesn't get profiled on the sheet, and it's a clever idea, so there's no profile. It looks like the bill is for free, but when you come back the next year, your general funds are reduced. By the same logic, you could say, well, you know, we're receiving mineral tax from natural gas. Let's intercept some of those funds before they arrive, or earmark them before they arrive at the general fund. And all it is earmarking. You're simply earmarking funds. So, Ken, are you the best person to ask to give us a summary of all of the revenues collected and where the monies are diverted and paid to and what goes to general fund, or is that something that we should get from the treasurer's office or from our staff?
Mr. Chairman, you're talking about the premium tax credits in the two programs I alluded to. I could get you those numbers. I don't know that I have them in my head.
Just a summary of all taxes collected, all premiums, including those for your budget, and show where they are going.
Sure.
And I just want everybody on the committee to understand that when you look at, and this goes back, if you look at the cost of our health care or Department of Health programs, they're actually more than we're profiled, because there are other programs we're funding by these interceptions or these earmarks. And it's important. I mean, we have these discussions every year because your colleagues will get up and say, look, this doesn't affect the general fund. We're going after these. Yes, it does. These are general fund. All taxes go to the general fund. And in theory, you could intercept all dollars.
Yes.
But if you give us a summary of those, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, I will. And just an example, for instance, in the Wyoming Health Insurance pool, our high-risk pool, which I refer to as WIP, there's a cap on assessments. And so when you get right down to it, based on the premium tax credits, the most they can get in premium tax credits in 1 year is $2.6 million. So that would give you an idea through WIP that every year you could have up to $2.6 million in premium tax credits that would not go in to the general fund. But I'll do a summary of the of all the programs for you.
The EMT program, or not, or the firemen's.
Yes.
Yeah.
If this is the appropriate time, on page 11, I'd just like an explanation of the premium tax credit and how that works, why it limits their income source.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lundflatern, if I'm on the same page 11, I think I'm looking at the same numbers. But, for instance, on our projections for 11, 12, and 13, 14 on premium taxes there, you know, that's over the biennium, obviously. So those are supposed to be actual collections, and those are estimates. And so when you divide that by two, you get a little less than $10 million a year, which is the amount I alluded to, that we actually put into the general fund. One reason, and I can get into more detail on this as to why there were less amounts, involves the small employer self or reinsurance pool, because around 2006 or 2007 there was a bill passed that amended how that was funded, and premium tax credits were not allowed for that previously, even though the insurance companies were assessed. But in revising that and to make it more appealing for insurance companies to use, the legislature passed a bill instituting a premium tax credit for the assessments in that fund. And they're very generous credits, I think, to say the least. It's 100% credit for the amounts assessed, the companies. And in addition, not only that, they get an additional 5% of that amount because they will lose the use of that money from the time they're assessed until they actually pay their premium taxes and can use the credit. So in effect, they're getting 105% premium tax credit in that program. And that obviously reduced the amount of premium taxes that we were actually putting in to the general fund. I think we were almost at the point where we were putting in $20 million a year, pretty close, until that particular credit was instituted. And there's been some additional bills since then that also are going to use premium tax credits, so this may even go down further.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how involved this is, but could you explain, you know, I don't know anything about this, so I'm trying to figure out what a premium tax credit, what they're billed for, what are they a credit against?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Senator, let me use the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool as an example. As I said, there, the way that's generally funded is the people in the pool pay a premium to be covered under the pool. And these are people that are unable to get insurance, health insurance from any other source, including any government program or anything. So they can't find health insurance. And it's in no way an entitlement or welfare program. They pay an excessive premium to participate in the pool. In fact, if you're in the high income part of the pool, it's divided into by 250% of the federal poverty guideline. If you're on the high end side, you're probably paying between 150 and 200% of what you would pay in the private market in insurance premiums. If you're in the low income part, you're somewhere between 100 and 135% paying premiums. So that funds the pool through premiums. But because these are sick people, the reason they can't get insurance is because they're sick people and they're not insurable. So claims are high in the pool. And so in addition to the premiums, health insurance companies licensed in Wyoming and operating in Wyoming are assessed a certain amounts, and there's a cap on that. But they can be assessed up to $6 million in the aggregate during 1 year. Typically in the last couple of years, I think they've been assessed more around $2 million, something like that. The way that premium tax credit works in WIP is on the first $2 million assessed, you get an 80% premium tax credit. So out of that $2 million, 80% of it can be taken back as a premium tax credit. For the second $2 million, you can take a 50% premium tax credit. And then for the third $2 million, if that's assessed, you get no premium tax credit in WIP. And as I said earlier, I think that comes out to the most is about $2.6 million that could be a premium tax credit in any given year. So that's how WIP works and how it's funded. And Chairman Nicholas pointed out, the way the state participates is that they grant the premium tax credit, and that money never hits the general fund. It's just taken as a credit when they fill out their tax reporting form, and they take that credit. So it never sees the general fund. And so that's basically how those credits work.
Mr. Chairman, so each company is individually assessed some fee that goes into the WIP program.
Right.
But we give them a credit for that first couple $1 million of 50%. So if they're assessed $100, they only actually pay $50. Is that how I get that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it really works. They pay the entire, it's based on their pro rata share of the premiums in Wyoming. So companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield or Wind Health that are local companies have a higher share of the market. They're going to pay more. But no, they pay that in. They don't take the credit until they're required to file their premium tax return in March of each year. Then that credit shows up on the form, and if they owe X amount of premium taxes, that credit is deducted, and then they pay in whatever is left. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to real quickly, because I know with regard to the administration budget, the committee was interested in knowing about our 10-year history of positions in the department, and I did a handout that you should all have. It's entitled Wyoming Department of Insurance 10-Year History of Positions. And it's pretty self-explanatory, but we started out in 2002 with 25 full-time employees. That stayed in effect until about 2007, and in that budget I had requested that we be given two additional positions to focus on market conduct issues, which is how insurance companies treat consumers. And so we were given those two additional positions, and so that we went to 27 positions in that year. You'll recall that in the prior administration, at some point there was a hiring freeze. And just through happenstance, we had three empty positions in the department at that time. And so we were not allowed to fill those positions during that hiring freeze. And then subsequently, in 2011, as you're aware, then those vacant positions were cut. So that dropped us to 24 employees in the insurance department. So we basically lost about 10% of our staff through that cut. During that time, we we didn't have any part-time employees and we didn't have any AWICs. So a pretty simple, we're down to 24 people now, and that particular exhibit shows you how that occurred and so forth.
Ken, if we were to go back and look at your actual budgets, say from 07 where you had the high of 27 people to now when you've got 24, has your budget grown? Or I assume at the first instance it got smaller, but if you look at today's budget versus, say, 07,
mm-hmm.
higher or lower today?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that budget in my head, but I would guess it's lower a little bit. We had some positions, you know, that got market increases because they had to get within, what's the latest one? Is it 90% of market? And so that increased some, I think. We also, because one of the positions we lost in the hiring freeze was our market conduct position, which I consider pretty important, and that is a higher paying position, we actually reclassified another position that we still had into that market conduct position, and so that would have left that amount of salary in there and kept that in the budget. But my estimate is our budget's a little bit lower than it was when we had the 27, but through other things like the market, bringing them up to market and so forth, it's probably inched back toward that similar amount, although I don't have that in front of me, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and that's the difficulty that we're going to have as we start to look at it, because if we have a 12% growth in our agencies, some of it's growth in programs, but in some instances, we already did reduce employment numbers, employment counts, but then we turned around and gave market raises. We have increased contributions being paid for retirement, and then we have increased health insurance. So
right.
You got a number of things that are all personnel-driven that drive up the of these. So there's part of me that says, well, your overall budget is still creeping up, but it's being done by things that at this point are out of your control.
Right.
And these smaller agencies, frankly, are going to get us. In some instances, people's employment numbers climb back, but in your case, you're now one position lower than 2002, and yet your budget is creeping up at a rate that, you know, what do you do? So when we get later on to your budget proposed cuts, you may give us some sort of feelings and thoughts about that, because you're a typical small agency that's it's hard to assess what we're going to do and how to do it, make sure it's fair and that you can deliver your services. But we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Other questions? If not,
yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
There's a handout here that's 058. That's a letter that seems to be should have been a two pager. It ends with a sentence. Just
I think you've turned. Oh.
And the big O.
that this doesn't have a back letter, but it's in the larger packet. Yeah, you know, the problem with that big packet, we don't have page numbers on it, so you just got to thumb through to hit agency 5044. And the agency numbers, so 44.
That's 37.
Where did you see 37?
Well, it's state engineer.
Oh,
that's their number.
Well, I know that.
So you're chairing appropriations and you can't count?
I can't. Well, no, there's no number on the front. He just happens to do the conversions.
It's practice.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Should have brought you mine. There you go. There's the handout, and here's the stuff. We'll number those things for you.
That's all right.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you were talking about the we provided a synopsis for general fund budget reduction, and I don't know if that's the exhibit you were just talking about. You only had the front page. I thought I checked those. I apologize for that. It should have been on the back. But you have it. Okay.
This means that we got copied. We only copied one side of it, so
okay.
It's not your fault.
Mr. Chairman, the only general fund, actual general fund money, aside from when you talk about premium tax credits, but the only actual appropriated general fund money I have in any of those four budgets is for the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool. And there is a $6 million general fund appropriation for WIP in the two previous bienniums. And just to give a little background on that, as I alluded to earlier when I was talking about premium tax credits, the WIP pool is divided into lower income and higher income individuals. And I think that happened back in about 2007, somewhere in there they divided that. And the problem was, I think the legislature felt the higher-income individuals were being able to afford the premiums in the pool, but the lower-income individuals, it was real tough for them to afford those premiums because, as I said, they ran from, and still do in that part of the pool, from 150 to 200% of the standard market. So the legislature instituted a cutoff of 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. And people below that are in what's called level two of the pool, which is the low-income part of the pool. And their premiums fall between 100% and 130% of the standard market, so they're paying less premium. And in order to support that, those lower premiums, the $6 million was appropriated to support only that part of the pool, that lower income part of the pool. It can't be used in the level one or higher income part of the pool. So basically, those amounts are used to help fund that part of the pool in addition to the premiums paid by the lower income participants. So if you look at the first page of my thing there, and I try to explain that in this synopsis, but if you look down toward the bottom part there, it's just a simple process of multiplying the percent that you want to cut times that 6 million. So, for example, 2% would cut 120,000 from that amount, 5% would cut 300,000, and 8% would cut $480,000 from that $6 million that's appropriated for that part of the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool.
When we're making payments, Ken, are we paying at the Medicaid rate or the usual and customary rate, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, you know, the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool is created by law as a separate entity, and it's overseen by a board of directors, of which I'm one of the members, and then I appoint the other members to that board. They adopt a plan of operation and also adopt the plans that are offered through WIP. And so, no, it's, I mean, we have our own plans, but they're pretty typical. You know, we try to make them so that they would be similar to a major medical plan that would cover things that people are going to need and so forth. So it's similar to what a private insurance company would do. WIP is basically a little insurance company. There's almost 1,000 people participating in WIP right now. It's grown over the past few years. And because we were down in the 600 to 700 level for many years, and we've had more participants lately. But, no, it adopts its own benefit plans and so forth.
I guess maybe a follow-up, Ken, and I'm just wondering if we paid it at 98% of what you're paying now, that would still get us to the 2% cut if we reduce the payment to the providers by 2%, is that essentially $120,000?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, let me talk about that a little bit, because that's really not – that $6 million is there. That $6 million is there to be available to pay those claims. But as I say later in my thing, in my little synopsis, we have not, over the past couple bienniums, used that entire $6 million to pay claims. And, of course, because it's general fund money, that reverts back any amount that we don't use to the general fund. The problem is, like with any insurance company, you know, the actuaries do projections on how many claims they think they're going to have over a period of time. And, of course, as I said, because WIP basically is a group of sick people because they can't get insurance anywhere, your claims typically are pretty high. And so what you really do when you reduce that $6 million is you're basically just reducing the amount that is available to pay claims. If you took those particular amounts out of that $6 million, that doesn't necessarily mean that we still wouldn't be able to pay claims on the actual claims results. But it also, in some ways, weakens the pool in the sense that it doesn't have that much in reserve to pay claims in case we had a bad year where we got some bad claims and we needed more money to pay claims. So that's kind of what you, and it's like any insurance business, you know, they keep a certain amount of reserves in place to cover projected claims. But even though that's done, you know, by an actuary scientifically, it's still an estimate of what those claims are going to be. So you never know if you're going to hit that or not. We've been lucky in the last couple years that we haven't had to use all that money. But what you're doing is you're reducing the amount of money that's available to pay those claims. And of course, WIP is not a state agency, is obvious. It's a separate entity. It's a little health insurance program. And who you're trying to serve are the Wyoming citizens that are in it and getting their claims paid. And so you hope that money remains available to pay those claims down the road.
Yeah. And Ken, can you kind of tell us on average what this particular program by itself has reverted to the general fund on an annual or biannual basis?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I can tell you that, if I can find it here, because we track WIP, we kind of divide it among the general fund and the rest. And, you know, the total budget for WIP is about $29 million, so $6 million of that is general fund. The rest comes from the assessments and premiums. But, for example, as of November 30th, in the current biennium, we have used, well, we're almost, it's at $2.9 million. We've used about half of that $6 million in the current biennium. and we have, I don't know how many months are left till next, the end of next June. And I can't tell you what amounts we'll use then, but I think we've, I don't recall last year's exactly, or last biennium's, how much we put back. I would guess it might have been close to $2 million, but that's just a guess on my part. But, you know, again, we've used about half of it so far this biennium, and what we'll use in the next months until June, I can't tell you, because we don't know what our claims are going to be actually.
Ken, when you look on page 22 where you've got your premiums, assessments, interest, total, now, in addition to that, do we have premium tax money going into it? It's just not reflected on that table. You got premiums, and I assume those are premiums paid by the employee and the state, do those premiums include as part of them the premiums that are paid that are the premium tax credits?
Mr. Chairman, no. Those are just the premiums paid by the participants, and those are estimates, and then what the assessments will be from the insurance companies, and then you have the general fund amount down there, the $6 million.
Assessments, are those then the component that,
yes,
some of which become tax credits?
Mr. Chairman, yes. In other words,
yeah,
it's the 80% on the first $2 million, the 50%
right
on the next $2 million.
And so, you know, I guess one of the questions I have is that I don't know if it's a worthwhile exercise or not, but if we take the premium tax credits and you add into it the general fund, $6 million, and you do that analysis to see what we're paying per person, it might be worthwhile you doing that for us, because as we begin to look at what we're paying per capita on these, and I know you may have to have two groups, one below 250% and those above 200%, 50%, but that would be useful for us as we begin to prepare for the analysis of the Healthy Frontiers and what we're paying per unit, per person there.
Sure. And so, Mr. Chairman, just so I understand, you'd like me to do a, in addition to the $6 million general fund appropriation, to know the specific amounts of the premium tax credits?
Yeah, it would look like, but if you know what your premiums are, your premiums are probably adjusted for, are they adjusted for age and family, or is it just... There's a yes coming behind you, so
yeah,
it's hard to tell. What it may be have to do is maybe take a couple typical snapshots of insureds and say, okay, here's somebody above the 250%. This is what the premium is. This is, for all practical purposes, if you add in the general fund and the premium tax, this is what the taxpayers are paying of that premium. Here's what the individuals are paying. And that's helpful to do it, because I tell you, we always receive comments that, particularly from these pools, that our premiums are, you know, too high, et cetera. And we need to, it would be helpful for us to say, well, look, of your premium, we're already paying X percent to subsidize
right
that. And so the subsidy, in essence, comes from, well, there's two levels of subsidy. One subsidy comes from the premium tax credit. One comes from just a tax that's not a credit. And then the other is from the $6 million. So what I'm really wanting to do is maybe say, okay, of a typical premium, this amount is subsidized by tax on the insurance that's not a credit. This percentage is a tax subsidized by insurance that is a tax credit, so it's general fund dollars for all practical purposes. And then this is subsidized by the $6 million. and maybe below, typical couple groups below and above the 250%. And that way, when these constituents call me, and I'm sure it's for others, we've received complaints of their premium amount, and ultimately it's nice to be able to say, well, look, we're already subsidizing these amounts. And then when we look at that amount of subsidies and the total amount of subsidies for all the programs divided by recipients, then that would give us some ability to kind of say, okay, you know, I'd like to compare that against what it's actually costing for Healthy Frontiers and things like that. So maybe you're going to have to give us sort of the data and then a couple analyses, but if we have all the input data, then we can move the dollars around. Does that make sense?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, see what we can come up with, and we may have to work with you later.
Mr. Chairman, a question on that. So if I understand the assessment aspect, there's a corresponding tax credit that normally would be general fund money paid later by the insurance company, but they get to deduct because they put money into this assessment. So what Ms. Chairman's asking for is to also add back in those deductions that they've received, and that's the true amount of money that that program is costing us divided by the 1,000 participants. And this is what we are paying per participant. Is that, and then take out their own fees, and that'll show us our assessment, our what we're subsidizing that program by. Is that what you're driving for?
Right. I think you got, and I think on the subsidies, I don't want to discount the assessments that are not general funded. The general fund assessments are subsidies that the taxpayer, in effect, is making. The other subsidy that is out of assessments is the subsidies that you and I that are insured pay, because ultimately if you're with Blue Cross, part of your premium embedded in that is their assessments that they have to pay for this. So ultimately it comes out of your pocket, but it comes out of one comes out of an assessment that's not a general fund credit, and the other portion is a tax that is a credit.
So, Mr. Chairman, you want to take the whole assessment value, not just and consider that part of a taxpayer's
right,
subsidy.
But I'd like it to have broken out. One is taxpayer, one is not reimbursed. So one's paid by all taxpayers, if you will. The other one's just paid by those who are insured by those insurance companies. All comes out of your pockets, and it's just helpful to know. So when you're on the floor and you're talking about these programs, understanding the total cost of them and realizing that, and you'll see movements to increase, and the programs change the programs, and each time it's costing somebody. It's not free money.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would also comment. I think the insurance companies would readily admit they passed those costs on.
Just a rough figure. It's about 52.69%. If you figure we're going to spend 3.5% in premium taxes, but that doesn't break it out between the two groups. So we subsidize the lower group more, and the higher group less. So there's going to be a different subsidy there. But you know, if you just toss a coin, you can just say we subsidize at least 50%. You know, so. And if you got 1,000 people, there, I guess you just divide the 14 million by 1,000, and that should tell us about what our subsidy is per person. So, what is it? Is that 1,400?
If the part of the Affordable Care Act remains that provides that you can continue into plans, is that going to diminish the demand for this program? And I assume if I'm sitting there and I'm with an employer, and I now have the opportunity to stay with that employer, then my premiums are going to be maybe lower than your premiums because the rest of the employer group is going to be paying for them.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think you're correct on that. And I think there's really a question. If the ACA, the federal law, was fully implemented, and that's questionable whether that's going to happen, but if it was, there would probably be no further need for the high-risk pool in Wyoming. They would be going through the insurance exchange and those type of places to get their insurance, and they may pay less than they would in our high-risk pool. I think you're correct.
Other questions? I think I'm not sure if we followed any type of a methodology or not. Ken, why don't you just take us through your exceptions.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On the administration budget, and let me find a page here, the only exception budget that we proposed was for our computer hardware replacements, and that is on, I believe, page 12. And we had an amount of $42,283 in there for replacement of computer hardware. And there's a paragraph under subsection A there that describes what we would do in the first year of the biennium and what we would do in the second. Now, as you already know, the governor's recommendation is for less than the amount we ask, and that's based upon the fact that it's my understanding that the CIO is going to enter into some kind of – is going to set amounts that you can pay for laptops and desktops and all that good thing. And so, I mean, I'm perfectly willing to accept their numbers on that. They indicate, I think they're recommending $27,254 for those replacements, and I'm fine with it.
Their argument is that they're actually going to provide to you the quality that you think you're going to get at less price by bulk purchasing. So
right.
We'll see if that works.
Okay. And again, Mr. Chairman, I'm fine with that amount. Well, and then there were some in that same area on page 14 in our 400 series, that same thing is happening through the IT services, and I think you're aware of that too.
When you hit those common IT reductions, where you don't have to.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the only other exception in our budget is for the small employer reinsurance program, which is if you go to page 27 of our budget, and I need to give you a little background on this budget. We had this discussion last biennium on this program. This program, as I said, is provided so that the insurance companies that are in the small group market, small employer market, which covers groups from 2 to 50 for small employers, you often have a situation where they may have an individual in one of those groups or maybe an entire group that is much sicker and costs in claims is much higher than the rest of that group or with other individuals. And so when you're doing your rating for these small groups, if you leave them in the group, the individual or the entire group, if it's a sick group, that's going to increase the rates for that group a lot, even though you may have one very sick person and, you know, 10 who are not. The purpose of the reinsurance pool is it allows the companies to pay a premium to that reinsurance pool and reinsure that person with the pool so that the pool will cover the claims of that high-cost person or that high-cost group if you have an entire group that's sick. And the purpose of that is to kind of mitigate the rate increases in the small group market. In other words, you're taking out your highest cost people and putting them in the reinsurance pool to be covered. And so you hope that mitigates the rates that are charged to the healthier groups and the individuals in the reinsurance pool. Um, The amount that we can budget for this program is limited by the statute that was amended, I think, back in 2006 or 2007. And it was amended back then by the legislature because a lot of the companies weren't using it. They weren't reinsuring people. And they wanted to make it more attractive for the companies to use. And so, again, this budget is funded by the premiums that the insurance companies pay to reinsure the groups or the individuals. And it's then funded also by the assessment of all insurance companies licensed in the state. And that was one change back in 2006, 2007, is only health insurers were assessed previous to that. And I think the legislative committee decided they wanted to assess all the insurance companies to support this and to have a higher assessment pool. But both the premiums that can be charged and the assessment amount is limited in the statute. So we can only assess and charge premiums for a certain amount of budget for that program. And again, back when they changed the law in 2006 or 7, they also created a premium tax credit for this program. There wasn't one before. And it's very, as I said, it's a very liberal credit. You get 100% credit for what you're assessed for. And you also get an additional 5% to pay you for the loss of your money from the time of use of your money from the time of the assessment until you actually use your premium tax credit when you file your tax return in March or whenever it is. And my recollection of the discussion before the committee was, in order to include all insurance companies, even though most of them don't sell health insurance, they are still going to be assessed, whether they're a property and casualty company or a title company or whatever kind of insurance company they are. The committee felt they had to give them a generous premium tax credit in order to assess them to operate the program. Well, to make a long story short, we have actuaries do projections on what the claims are going to be in this pool. And again, this is a pool, they're even sicker than the people in the WIP pool because they're usually really high-cost people that have been pulled out of the small group or whatever. And so their claims are projected to be very high. So when you get down to figuring how much you can estimate you're going to get in premiums and how much you're going to get in assessments, that basically limits your budget and gives you an amount that you can have to pay for claims. Well, the actuaries project claims way above that amount that they estimate will happen. Now, I have to tell you, we had this same issue in the last biennium where the actuaries estimated those high amounts. And, you know, actuaries, they're just doing their job. They have to be conservative, and they have to, you know, we may have bad claims, and this is what we think the estimate is. If you want me to explain how actuaries do their jobs, I'm not going to be able to do that because that's way beyond my ability to do because I'm not an actuary. But, for instance, just example in the current biennium, and again, this is as of the end of November. Our budget last time was $24 million in the current biennium, and we have spent about $12 million, I think, to date so far. And so we, even though there were projections from actuaries last year that we were going to go over this amount, we haven't hit them yet. We haven't had those bad claims for whatever reason. But what we feel we have to do is we feel we have to budget because, again, this is a framework budget where the premiums and the assessments flow into it. We feel the budget should be at the maximum that we can do on premiums and on assessments. And so in this year's budget, in order to hit that, that would increase this budget about $2.5 million in order to allow those premiums and assessments to flow into that budget. And the governor's recommendation was to allow that particular exception request. I will tell you that this is also a program overseen by a board. It's a separate entity. And they do have a contingency plan in place of what they would do if we didn't have enough money to pay 100% of claims in that. And that would basically be to be reduce the percentage of claims that you paid. You know, you might have to reduce it on each claim to paying 75%. Now, that would, if you did that, and we haven't had to do that yet, that would not fall back on the state of Wyoming. That would fall back on the original insurance company to pick up the, say, if we were only paying 75% of that claim, the original insurance company that reinsured would pay the additional 25%. So it wouldn't be the state that would be doing that. But it's kind of a weird budget in that way. And so, again, we project, we ask for the total amount we can get through what's projected through premiums and through assessments. And that increased that budget by $2.5 million from the, I think, what was it, $24 million last year or last biennium. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try and answer questions on that particular one.
Let me ask you, I think I understand the notion that if the program as it's constituted drives the amount of reinsurance subsidy to maintain that same level of reinsurance, you're at $2.5 million additional, which ultimately hits the general fund because that reduces premium taxes that flow to the general fund. So for all practical purposes, it is a general fund appropriation because it's reducing our revenues to that. My question then, is that right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the premium tax credits would be for the assessment part of the budget. Right. And so, yeah, whatever, you know, it increases it from about $24 million to $26.8 million. From the last biennium.
And the entire 26.8 would then become someone's premium tax credit, which will reduce direct dollars flowing into the general fund? Or is there a component of that that's not
right,
assessment?
Mr. Chair, the premiums paid would not be a part of that premium. It would be the assessment part of it.
Mr. Chairman, question on it.
So the assessment part is being assessed anyway. It's just more spending authority we're giving you. I guess I'm confused on that because that money was going to be paid anyway, and the tax credits that we speak of were going to happen anyway. It's just giving spending authority.
Well, Mr. Chairman, essentially, Senator, that's true. In other words, again, I call this a framework budget in the sense that the premiums flow into it and the assessments flow into it. And, you know, we assess the companies when we need money to pay claims. And that could be 6 months or 10 months before they actually take their premium tax credit in the next year. But the premium tax credits would just apply to the assessment part. And the way the legislature did that, they limited assessments to 40% of the gross premium taxes of, I believe, the prior year, something like that. So there is a cap on what can be assessed. But then it's basically a wash for the company because they're going to get 100% tax credit on that. And not only that, they're going to get an additional 5% for the loss of the use of their money for that time period, that gap between when they're assessed and when they actually claim the premium tax credit.
So you said that last bit, I thought I understood it, but it, I mean, if it's a reinsurance program, I assume I pay a premium. For typical reinsurance, I pay a premium to insure a risk above X. So I pay a dollar for insurance, and then if I have a claim that goes above X, then I get my money back, and all insurance companies are reinsuring themselves. In this instance, there's what you're saying is that there is a premium that's paid for by the carriers into, in order to be reinsured, are you saying then that of that premium, a portion is subsidized and a portion is not subsidized?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the company is going to both, the health insurance company is both going to pay a premium, and then they're also going to be assessed to support the pool. And they are going to get a premium tax credit for their what they pay in assessments.
That equal ultimately 100% of their premiums.
It will equal 100% of their assessment. I don't think it will equal on the premium side. That they still have to pay that premium. Am I correct?
That's what I mean. I assume that.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds complicated. You'd have to diagram it out for us. But I assume that as are you in the end of the day. I mean, going back to that same analysis, if I'm paying a dollar premium for this, and at the end of the day, will I get a credit somewhere along the line against my tax, my premium taxes for the entire dollar, or will only be a portion of that?
Mr. Chairman, the only thing they get a premium tax credit for is what they're assessed for to support the pool. The premiums they pay for reinsurance goes to the pool. They wouldn't get a premium, any kind of premium tax credit on that. That's the premium they pay to reinsure that particular person or group. And that goes to the pool to use to pay claims or whatever.
Well, I guess what I'm having, I mean, if you look at the base budget of $24 million, and the fund source is E, which is probably category is for, those would be your premiums. Well, we have, okay, let's go back. We've got insurance company reimbursement, $16 million. Then you've got investment income, and then you've got your health insurance premiums. Now, when we look at that, the insurance company reimbursement, the 16.8, the insurance companies are paying for that? And is there any tax credit available for that component?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, the insurance company, whatever that is, reimbursement, I guess that is, that's the assessment part of it. So they would get a premium tax credit for that. But then you go below where it says the health insurance premiums.
Right.
I think that's the premium they pay and would not get a credit for.
So presumably, if they're paying $7 million total, the reason they're participating in the plan is because that $7 million cost to them would be less than going for private reinsurance.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, although it's interesting to note that only our two domestic companies, Blue Cross Blue Shield and Wynn Health, are the only participants in the reinsurance pool. And that makes me think the other companies that are not Wyoming domestics are doing exactly what you said. They're going to their own reinsurance. But I
think we do want that, but I think I'm going to be able to understand. On the 16.8, though, that sounds like that's a pure tax subsidy. I mean, it eventually becomes a credit against your taxes, which reduces the flow to the general fund.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Chairman, the only limit on that is, quite frankly, because there's several programs that give premium tax credits, they sometimes run out of tax to take the credit against.
And well, so to the extent that that happens, then that's becomes, you would assume that you would add that premium plus the subsidized premium, unsubsidized, and it must still be cheaper or less expensive than private reinsurance.
I make that assumption, Mr. Chairman.
I mean, can you give us, Co-Chairman Berger was saying give us a flow chart, but maybe on this, if you look at, say, before and after the total exception request, so a flow chart based upon the 24 and on the 26, to show how what the subsidized premium is, and I sense you don't enjoy that language. Maybe you come up with a different one, but there's a subsidized and non-subsidized, so we know what the how much of that will ultimately reduce general fund spending, or not spending, general fund revenues. And then I guess I'm kind of curious with respect to then how do we assess at this point is if the program is driving on a reinsurance basis and in, there's an incremental general fund increase each time that you have a proposed exception request, how do we continue to assess whether it's a financially beneficial program to the taxpayer versus the insurance company? I mean, if you go back to the beginning, you said, hey, this is your skin in the game, this is the insurance company's skin in the game, and this is why it's a good deal. How do we continue to assess that incrementally as we put more money into it?
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I think it's difficult, too, because, and I've asked insurance companies this, because the whole idea is to mitigate the rates in the small group market. And, of course, we're not. When I talk about mitigate, we're not talking about them going down or leveling out. It's just maybe decreasing the rate of increase. And it's very hard to, I don't know how you quantify that or get data to show that that's happening in the small group market. You know, the companies, the insurance companies will tell you it has to affect it. It has to help because when they do their rating, which is restricted in the small group laws, how they do that, you're taking out these sick people with lots of claims. So it somehow has to help in that rating factor. But how you pull that data and figure that out for sure, I think is difficult. But we certainly can do what you were talking about.
What did you do? Can you find out, are these entities generally uninsurable and reinsurance risks, and that's why we had a problem, or is this, I mean, I remember that the folks that were pushing for something like this, but I'm not sure that they said, hey, we can't get reinsurance, or whether the reinsurance is too expensive.
Right.
Or whether this was just an effort to take really tax dollars to subsidize private insurance premiums.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that, and I don't want to speak for the companies, I would guess, yeah, that at least if they're using it, they feel like the premium's better in the pool than it is where they can get it in the private. Again, I don't want to speak for them. But, you know, in the small group, part of the small group market is you have to take all comers. It's not like the individual market where you can reject people because of their health background. In the small group market, the company's going to do small group. They have to take all the employees that want to sign up in that small group. And so you're going to have a certain amount who are healthy and a certain amount who are sick and a certain amount who are really sick. And so that was the idea, is to pull those people out of when you're rating that group and put them in the reinsurance pool so that it would mitigate the rates in that remaining pool, the people in the pool.
Part of my concern is a very, very non-transparent subsidy that we do for a limited number of employers. Not everybody gets it, and we don't know which employers are getting it. As far as I have no idea, for example, whether my law firm is getting some of this. I'd have no way of knowing. I guess maybe could we get from the participants, companies, some indication of which, who's benefiting from this and what the benefit is to these carriers. And if it's only three or four employers and, I guess how, another way, Ken, to request it is that if we're spending, suppose there's $26 million here and suppose half of it is general funds, so $10 million being paid out to somebody, is it benefiting five employers or two employers or one in Riverton or one in Laramie? I kind of like to kind of see what our $10 million is getting and how broadly it's based and or how narrow it's based so we know whether it's not just a gift to one or two people.
But. And I guess if you wanted to make it transparent, what you do is that if a small group if the insurance company moved one of the individuals off a small group plan into this, you know, then they would put on their premium billing that your premium has been subsidized by $18,000 by the Wyoming pool, you know. And then they'd know exactly that they were getting subsidized by that pool. We'd know that they were, and I don't know whether they could do that or not, but the insurance company certainly knows what groups have people pulled out of them and put into the pool, and they should be able, when they do their premium rate on that pool, they should be able to figure that out, because that's how they're supposed to adjust their premiums based on the subsidy back to them. And so that should be transparent in the premium billing process, so we know what it is, and they're not moving that across to all employers, but because it's really drawn out of that one group.
And, Mr. Chairman, I do have to say, I don't think it, you know, it's the insurance company that decides who they're going to reinsure. I'm not sure that becomes apparent to the small group or the small business that's being insured.
That's what I'm saying. It should become apparent to them. So, you know, when these people complain that their insurance rates are going up, then they know that they got, you know, a $15,000, $20,000, or $80,000 or $5,000 or whatever subsidy, you know.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I guess my thoughts on that, having done some of this, there are HIPAA rules, and we were always very, very careful about particularly reinsurance, because when an employer becomes aware that they may have an employee that's dragging them down, it's an incentive to remove that employee. So we had to be – so I don't believe – in my experience having done reinsurance, I don't believe that we ever notified the employer that their employee – that a certain employee was ceded to the reinsurance pool for very strict HIPAA stringent reasons.
That's – I think I would believe you're – I mean, I assume that when I buy health insurance that my company is reinsuring the outliers. So I buy insurance, they buy insurance, and in fact, that insurance company may buy another layer of insurance, and there may be three layers of premiums going in there. What I think that we ought to at least demand or insist at this point is, you know, kind of identify what is our subsidy. So if our subsidy is X dollars, and then how broadly is that subsidy being applied? How many companies are in it? How many small groups in it? If for example, what if we found out that there's only one small group in town that's getting it, and they're getting $10 million, and we essentially wrote them a $10 million check? You probably wouldn't like that. If it's across 15 companies and each carrier is getting, you know, $1,000 a year, I mean, it's no different than saying we're going to return sales tax credits to folks who collect the sales tax. We're saying there's a group of people, we're going to take our tax dollars and we're going to return tax dollars to a group of people. And we explain that we're doing that because they're paying for the cost to collect that. Now we're sending tax dollars to a group of people that we don't even have an identity of what they are or how much they're getting. So I think with that in mind, Ken, see what you can produce for us. And it may be that the insurance companies can then, if they want to provide some information explaining and justifying it, that's fine. But basically, how much tax dollars are going in, how broadly is it being applied, and how do we assess whether we're getting the taxpayer is getting an appropriate distribution?
Sure. And, Mr. Chairman,
And I'd say that even in maybe addition to that is whether or not that the taxpayer is actually getting any relief from premiums, you know, or whether it's just an entire gift to the insurance company, you know. Representative Edmonds, I think you're right about the HIPAA thing. Yeah, just coming back to my days. But I think we should be able to get that information in the aggregate. We should be able to figure out whether or not you know, these folks are actually getting some relief. if they are, then to the extent that they're carrying insurance on their employees and not just dropping the whole coverage, then that makes the system a little bit more viable. And I think that's probably one of the underlying reasons for having the program.
Well, my recollection is when the program came about 5-6 years ago, there was a concern that carriers were leaving the markets for small to medium-sized companies, and they just weren't offering to them. And part of the issue was there was no reinsurance available because it was too expensive. So now we have a program, but we have no idea if those, one is, were the assumptions correct? Two, is it addressing the assumptions? Or three, has the market changed so that reinsurance is readily available now and there's no reason to give a $10 million subsidy to somebody? So I think it's just, let's reexamine it and take a look at it and see if we could find that information.
Do that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, and also if you can provide, if you've noticed any trends in the changes that we made in 06, particularly, you know, seating the newbies without parents, has that increased the risk? I mean, are we seeing more and more people coming on for, you know, because premiums tend to be pretty expensive. So are we seeing any trends in what we in the legislature did? I think that would be probably beneficial for us to understand when we made those changes, if it affected.
Mr. Chairman, we can do that. I can tell you, Representative Edmonds, that, you know, the lives in the pool, reinsured lives, has gone way up as a result of those changes. So the companies are using it more for whatever reason.
Mr. Chairman, on a quick little final note, I'd like to ask Director Vines, does he agree that the CE requirements for individual producers is probably exorbitant? I'm just teasing. It's hard. I have to do it every year, though.
We make sure Representative Pedersen files the appropriate paperwork. So. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. I am Pat Anderson, Executive Director of the Board of Parole. Behind me, I have Joanne Strubing, our Business Office Coordinator, and Mr. Dan Fetzko, Deputy Director for the Board. Mr. Chair, would you like a brief overview of the agency operations, or would you prefer to jump right into the budget? What the board does, for anybody who may not know, is travels around the state to the five Department of Corrections penal facilities and the three community corrections programs in the state, and conducts interviews with inmates who are eligible for parole and makes the decision whether or not to grant a parole. This is done by three-member panels. We have seven members on the board who are appointed by the governor. Three members act as hearing panels and make these trips twice a month, sometimes more, depending on demand, to conduct these hearings. I think the big question, or the big question the public has about releasing inmates to parole, is why? How does that help the state? How does that help the citizens? And that's really what the board's mission is all about. There's plenty of evidence out there now to support that offenders, felony offenders in particular, who are incarcerated, have a better chance of reintegrating into the community and not reoffending if they have preparation while they're incarcerated. They are released with certain conditions and with supervision, and they have folks to monitor their behavior in the community for a period, keep them on track, hopefully get them engaged in pro-social behaviors, which hopefully will stick, as opposed to the option, which is to simply let them finish their number in prison and walk out, no strings attached. So the board's primary performance measurement is the percentage of all inmates who are released each year who go on to successful paroles rather than just finishing their sentence in prison and walking out. And I'm happy to report that in large part with the assistance of the legislature in approving initiatives over the last few years, we have really turned the curve on that measure. And actually in the last biennium, we've improved 10% on the percentage of inmates who are going out to successful paroles as opposed to just finishing their sentence and walking out. And the raw numbers are in the budget, so I won't spend too much on those, but essentially we are up in almost every category. We're up in the number of hearing days in the last fiscal year from the previous one. We're up in the number of parole interviews. We're up in the number of parole grants. We're down in the number of revocation hearings, which is a good indicator. And overall, we are seeing more inmates now for the first time in history that I know of. More inmates are coming out to paroles than are just finishing up their sentences. And again, I think that's the result of several initiatives that the legislature has helped us with, including parole good time as an incentive for inmates to prepare for and seek and do well on a parole, intermediate jail sanctions and community correction sanctions as an option to revocations in the community. And so we are doing quite well. Jumping to the budget, the standard budget, without any exception requests and with cuts, our standard budget has not changed since our real first budget request in the 04-05 biennium. The only increases that you'll see is what everybody else has experienced with raise to market, cost of living allowance increases to the 100 series, and we did increase by one staff person. One position was approved by the board in 2004 as an exception request. Since that request, in 2006, we have remained stable at seven full-time employees. In terms of the cuts that we are proposing, and they're in the handout, basically the only areas that we feel comfortable proposing cuts is in the area of our travel expenditures next to personnel costs. Because the board travels so extensively, that is our next most significant budget item. And as I have discussed with this committee in the past, we are very fortunate to have had the use of one of the governor's airplanes to conduct our travel. Historically, as far as I know, at least for the last 20 years, the board has always had this as a travel option. It became critical between the late 90s and up until about 2009, when all of the DOC inmates were finally brought home from out of state as a means to get out and see those inmates. Just to kind of anticipate a question, which may be in some people's minds, why does the board need to go and see inmates face-to-face to make their decisions? And when I hear people talk about the state of Wyoming and state government and some of the benefits that we have by being a small state population-wise, what I always hear about is that we have this contact, this personal contact between citizens and government, including the executive branch and the legislature and even up to the governor, so that almost anybody in Wyoming or anybody in Wyoming can give their representative a call, can probably get an appointment with the governor, can certainly talk to state agency heads. And because of our numbers, we have a relatively low prison population. We have about 2,200 felony inmates locked up at any given time. It's very rare, I will say, among the rest of the country, that our board actually gets to meet individually with each offender when it's considering whether or not to release them onto a parole. And I think that enables the board as well to do better decision-making. Imagine, if you will, if you had to conduct these hearings with agency heads appearing by telephone or by televideo. The board has done some of that, did not find it to be a very satisfactory experience. So that's my pitch for the importance of the board going out and conducting hearings.
Pat, on the teleconferencing, is the lack of satisfaction just not being able to see the person and sort of get the sort of the feel of being there, or is it could it be attributed to lack of quality for the video conferencing? So that maybe the question is when you did test it out, did you have high quality video? And or was it choppy and with poor sound, that sort of thing?
Mr. Chairman, a little of both. But I will say the quality issue resolved by the last time the board was utilizing televideo. That was for inmates who were in Virginia, and we were able to use Department of Corrections equipment here in Cheyenne, and really the quality was excellent, as compared to the past where the board had experimented with things like Skype or where transmission lines and equipment was not very good in the past. That was a big factor then. Now the bigger factor, I think, is just the quality of interaction and being able to kind of establish that connection, the ability to really look the offender in the eye, and to the extent that is possible, gauge sincerity, and get a feel for the individual. Another factor when we talk about televideo that needs to be considered is that our members are scattered all over the state. So how do we do that if we were required, if it became necessary to do that? I suppose we'd either still have all the members travel to a central point, which is what we're doing now, or we would have to have that capability in each of their locations. Not all of them are in metropolitan areas that have, state-of-the-art type video equipment. We have members, one's 40 miles out of Thermopolis, one is in Robertson, Wyoming, Casper, Cheyenne, I can't make that argument, Gillette, But, you know, and then again, I've experienced that when you conduct a meeting by electronic communications, it does kind of impede the flow of discussion. People who are at remote locations may not be as eager to volunteer or participate as they would if they were face-to-face. So I don't think there's any question that personal meetings are superior. However, fortunately, the cuts that we are proposing, we believe we would still be able to travel to conduct hearings, even in the worst case 8% scenario. It's just that we would be driving instead of flying.
I assume that when we look at the travel budget of $289,000, so it's half of that each year, that a significant part of that is to be able to commandeer the jet and I don't underestimate that. I mean, it's hard to get volunteers to be on your board at all, I assume, and then making it difficult for them to get to meetings is hard. With respect to the video conferencing, if the issue is that it's difficult for a small staff to commandeer quality sites, we have the capacity to require that ANI, the schools, the community colleges provide assistance on systems that we're paying for. So, and if you're interested in or you want to explore that again with where we find the resources for you so you can set up your meeting and other people will set up the call centers, and we can do that and then maybe see if you know, for us, the legislature, if we want meetings, we're able to have our staff set it up, and we could have ANI responsible for getting you sites and trying it. And maybe if you want to try that again and see whether the present state of video conferencing is good enough to eliminate some of that traveling, we could help you there, I think.
Well, Mr. Chairman, certainly, you know, with the uncertainty now about the state's budget as a whole, I think we need to have those types of options in mind. Again, if we can get all the members to a central location like Cheyenne, not an issue because the county library now has a video. ANI actually has a video center in the old county library. Department of Corrections has been very accommodating. But if you're talking about taking it a step further and making it available throughout the state so that members actually wouldn't have to travel, I think that's something worth exploring, you know, particularly if it comes to pass that we don't have the state airplane available. That may be a preferable option during the winter months to driving long distances.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be as much a question for you as it is for this agency. Are we going to have, I assume this is the first time I've been through this whole rodeo, so a point in time where we really look at the usage of the state airplane and
yes.
The jets, and I've been curious about their utilization and how the costs that go into them sort of match up with like jet card, private jet charter, and whether we might have an opportunity to find some value with a little different model at some point.
Be great. Let's. I mean, generally that comes up in YDOT budget. So in YDOT running that, they almost every year get a request from legislators to show the utilizations, the priorities. Oftentimes there's fights between the executive folks who gets to commandeer the priorities and then the agencies. So what we'll do, and I can see the Bill's writing his notes, ANI is writing the notes, so let's have them bring us the latest defense and description of the justification for the jets and the cost and the and we'll get those sorts of things. So we'll have that.
Mr. Chairman, I think YDOT
I think YDOT does publish that regularly. We used to actually get an email showing the usage. I have not seen one in probably almost a year, but I assume maybe on their website you'd actually see the hours used, what department used it, what the costs are. It used to be there anyway.
I'm kind of thinking that probably what happened is that, as a practical matter, there was a higher scrutiny when there were different political parties in the executive branch, and now that they're all the same political party, there's less scrutiny. So, but Representative Wallace says we want to have that scrutiny, so we'll get it.
Mr. Chairman, what I'd really like to see is I was not aware of these private jet chartering programs until fairly recently. I'm sure they've probably been out there for years. But what I'd really like to see is an analysis of, you know, depending on the needs of the agencies and the use of the planes, and how often are two entities needing and wanting the plane at the same time, and could that well, whatever, you know. What I'm saying is there may be times when we might need five, and then weeks when we don't need any. I want to see if that's the case and see if there's some, if we would actually come out better on a value situation by going to private enterprise.
All right, so when we get to YDOT, we're going to need to have them provide us some backup. And as a practical matter, folks, I'd say is this, is that the acquisitions of the two jets were legislatively driven. They were not executive branch driven. And at that time, really, one of the strongest advocates of it was Senator Larson. And part of Senator Larson's point was that they never got to see the governor. Everybody down here gets to see the governor, and they sort of felt like the governor and the elected official belong to the state of Wyoming, and they ought to be able to get in a jet and go wherever they want. Once we have the jets, then the issue becomes who else gets to use them, what's the priorities. And what the governors would typically tell us is that getting people to sit on the parole board is not easy. And if you know that every time you want to, I hereby volunteer to travel from Jackson to wherever you want once a month, whatever it takes, that's a hard commitment. And particularly with the Environmental Quality Council, where the meetings have grown to a point you have volunteers having to go lots of meetings, having the access to jets was huge. So once you build it in, there's a fixed cost that goes with them, with the pilots and the facilities, all of which goes into your question, and that is, when is it less expensive, and are we ever going to allow chartering of private services to do this? And we have other airplanes, by the way. UW's got an airplane, and there's some other planes out there. So this is something we should be well advised of. And so once we give, it's a defense that's typically made, and you need to have all the information. So we'll alert YDOT to come loaded with that information. Or if you want, we can make Pat go collect all that information and have him come back. I mean, there's no reason why he shouldn't have to do it.
Glad to.
Okay, so when we get to YDOT, we'll get all that information so we're up to speed on it. You know, sometimes I've had half-an-inch stuff, so it's a big issue, and you ought to be able to have it. Any other questions of Pat? If not, thanks, Pat. Appreciate having you, and we'll go on to Diane and her budget. Diane, welcome. Before we get started, what's the status of the GAL problem, and I know, or issue slash, and I know there's some legislation that's sitting over on my desk that you've been working with Mr. Gruver about.
Mm-hmm.
If you just give a background on the GAL issue, why we need some legislation and that sort of thing.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Madam Co-Chair Berger. Good morning. Essentially, the Guardian Ad Litem program was transferred to the Office of the State Public Defender, and it went into effect July 1st of 2008, and it was done so by session law. Within that session law, near the end of the session law, there was a requirement that the office request funding for the Guardian Ad Litem program for the 2009 and 10 budget year. And then with no reference to 2011 and 12 or to the budget year that we're in now or for the upcoming budget for which we're here to talk to you about today. It makes me a little nervous. I'm not sure what statutory authority the state public defender has to keep running the Guardian Ad Litem program. I'm not necessarily a legal scholar in what that means if there's not a session law or some other statute that talks about what we should and should not be doing and what our authority is. So we gave the governor's office a heads up that we wanted to maybe look into codifying that session law and creating a statutory framework for the Guardian Ad Litem program that would include some of the things that the Public Defender Act has in regard to what we have the authority to do, whether or not our attorneys are covered by the self-employment insurance and the Governmental Claims Act and those types of things. So Stacey Obrecht, who's here today, she's the deputy of the Guardian Ad Litem program, and the deputy, Ryan Roden, drafted some legislation or a proposed bill, I guess, a draft, and gave it to LSO, and it's my understanding that Senator Chairman Nicholas has been looking at that. So that is one thing that we're requesting. Good. And, Mr. Chair, I would say that the session law in 2008 also, you know, required us to promulgate rules and regulations. So we do have rules and regulations in place. So we do have, you know, authority that has the same effect as the law in place. Just we had, you know, personally and legally some questions about whether or not we needed something stronger than that.
Well, it sounds like that then going forward, we'll get on top of the legislation as we move it through through January. And then, but we may require a budget amendment just to make sure the program is authorized, regardless of the adoption of the statute, or we can eliminate the funding if you guys want to. I mean, it's up to you. But the so that's just a note. Appreciate it. Okay, with that in mind, why don't you, you've got your folks here, go ahead and introduce your folks and take us through your budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sitting at the table with me is Brian Young. He's the director of our administrative services, which means he's our fiscal officer, among other things. Ryan Roden is the deputy state public defender. He's also with us today. And then the guardian ad litem, deputy Stacey Obrecht, and Rob Galick, who's basically the head of our IT department, is also here today. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I would like to maybe just give a quick summary about how we're doing over at the State Public Defender's Office, and then I think we have some explanations to give you on some of the handouts that we're requesting before we actually go into our proposed reductions and then our exceptions budget. Generally speaking, things seem to be evening out as far as caseloads go at the Public Defender's Office and the Guardian Ad Litem program. We had, at the end of fiscal year 11, we had been assigned 13,735 new cases on the public defender side, so that means crimes, misdemeanors, and felonies. That went down slightly from fiscal year 10, but since fiscal year 09, there's still a little bit of an increase, maybe a 2% increase in caseloads. We are still working on improving our in-house case management or case tracking system. We've changed a little bit how we count cases that I think is more expressive of the work that we actually do. We're also implementing a case waiting system that I hope someday can help us better understand our cases and what they mean and how we can tie that to funding, although I think we're getting better at that. In the Guardian Ad Litem program, of course, in 2010, that budget was reduced by $500,000, so we had to tweak, if you will, the hourly rate for the attorneys We also implemented a payment policy, which in the end, maybe we were a little overcautious on some of the cuts that we made, but we, I think, have a much better handle of on what is being billed, what kind of work the taxpayers are paying for on the Guardian Ad Litem program. The caseloads went down, again, a little slightly. We had 2,187 cases that were assigned to us in fiscal year 2010 and fiscal year 11. It dropped to 2,153, you know, probably a minimal drop. We're getting assigned about 880 new abuse neglect cases or CHINS cases in the Guardian Ad Litem program. So, you know, as it stands now, I feel that if caseloads continue to be the way that they are, if our cases don't change too much, we should be okay, even with some of the proposals for reduction that we'll give you here in a little bit. Okay, so as far as that goes, we were asked to give you a list of our major vendors in the 900 series. I believe that the format that we gave it to you in is done alphabetical by vendor's first name, and it doesn't separate out by project code or even unit, you know, so, you know, public defender, a list for public defender vendors or a list for guardian ad litem vendors. For me, it was more helpful to have it divided into that kind of category. So if you would like to see it in what I think is probably a more useful format, we can get that to you.
Diane, okay. In the future, I mean, you can just give us the summaries, for example, with,
okay.
You know, if you take Copenhaver's law firm, just give us a total. You don't have to give us month-by-month payments.
Okay.
Save a little bit of paper. And,
sure.
And in these cases, almost, I'm just looking through, almost all of them are to law firms who I assume are essentially doing your contract work throughout the state.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
If folks want to ask any questions about any of those payments, I know that we've asked you on occasionally, but I also think you're a good, you know your budget and when it makes more sense to hire somebody as opposed to contract them, but that's something you look at typically. And
it is, Mr. Chair. And when we get into the exceptions budget, you know, we did ask for a couple positions that the governor did not recommend, particularly in the Guardian Ad Litem program, and then one position that we were going to fund through 900 series by cutting a contract, one whole contract and another partial contract, to help us with a tremendous caseload increase in Fremont County. But, you know.
There, you might talk about whether or not you defended on the, I mean, you asked for new positions, but I don't think you said, look, you can reduce our other series. So then ordinarily, I mean, if you've got $100,000 out of contracting and you move but from the 900 series to the 100 series for employment, that's a little bit different than adding a position but leaving your 900 series money in. So when you get there, you'll talk to us about that.
Okay, sounds good. The other handout that we gave you was our historical for the last 10 years, our FTEs for the agency. And by my calculations, and I'm not a mathematician by any means, but it looks like our FTEs have increased by about 25% in the last 10 years. And just to make myself feel comfortable about that, I went and looked at caseloads for the last 10 years, and on the public defender side, caseloads increased by 37%. And then, of course, the Guardian Ad Litem program got added, so those FTEs, we added one, and then the last budget session we were given positions so that we had some full-time employee attorneys doing the work, and then we needed some help on the administrative side. So that's the explanation for those changes in the FTEs. And, Mr. Chairman, the final handout was the 600 series, and that one deserves a little bit of explanation. The 600 series sheet that we gave you is the payments that were made toward student loans through the John R. Justice Grant Program. Governor Friedenthal designated our agency as the administrator of that grant. Essentially, that grant helps prosecutors and public defenders who agree to continue their public service for at least 3 years to pay back their student loans. And it requires that there be a calculation of the student loan debt and actual income, so it's based on need. And we were allocated $100,000 for 2010. We set aside $10,000 for administrative costs, which we, in all reality, didn't need that much. So we were able to give $90,000 in student loan payments, and we had to do it equally among prosecutors and public defenders. So the same amount of public defenders and the same amount of prosecutors. And everybody who applied this year were able to receive money for that. It's not something that's in our budget or in the budget book that you see, but it is in the 600 series. We were also, I think our allocation for 2011, we did reapply. Governor Mead asked us to do that, and it's $104,000. We'll probably ask for maybe $500 of that to be administration, so we'll have more money to help prosecutors and public defenders pay back their student loans.
How about the other lawyers? Just only PDs and prosecutors, huh?
Yep.
Calculate this into their benefit plan, was reduce their salary. How's that?
Yeah, I'm sure they would love that, Mr. Chair. Okay, the next thing, Mr. Chair, would be our proposed standard budget reductions and okay, we could do that. And the exceptions budget, Mr. Chair? Okay. Okay, then page 12 is on the budget booklet is the beginning of our exceptions budget. The first priority number one was a request for an attorney position in Lander or our Fremont County Trial Division. That division handles all of Fremont County, but they travel back and forth between Lander and Riverton, of course, in the United States Judicial District. The request there was to take the 900 series money and to move it into the 100 series so we could get a full-time employee there, and the governor did not recommend that priority.
Would have been a revenue neutral?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And did you, as revenue neutral on the salary part, how about office and overhead?
There would... you know, Mr. Chair, I don't know that I have exact numbers for you, but certainly we would have to provide office furniture and a computer for that attorney. We do have office space there, and we have room for the attorney, so it wouldn't cost us more in lease. Also,
you have staff there too, secretary already.
We have two legal assistants and an investigator, Mr. Chair, and Fremont County is good about providing money for the office stipends that is required by the Public Defender Act.
When you met with the governor, did he understand that this would have been revenue neutral?
Mr. Chair, I believe so. We did point that out.
Well, I guess here's the issue for me. If it's revenue neutral and you're going from 900 to 200, you're getting a full-time lawyer, do you have a sense of whether or not by having a full-time lawyer over the contract, whether your clients are going to be better served by having a full-time lawyer that's really dedicated to theirs and not sharing his private practice with essentially with your caseload?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's exactly my sense and my belief. And you know, based on my 17 years with the Public Defender's Office, we have good attorneys who are contract attorneys, but certainly they have more than one master, and it's not necessarily the public defender client. The caseloads in Fremont County went from being our sixth busiest office to our third busiest office. They actually right now have more open cases than Natrona County, and we monitor open cases, so that means something. They don't just have a bunch of cases left open so it looks like they're busy. We actually track how long cases are open, and we have an ongoing dialogue. We have an audit process where we look at open cases. So, really all we're doing in Fremont County with this request is increasing the FTE by only 0.25, but by taking away a contract there and moving it in-house and then supplementing it with a contract out of Natrona County is probably the plan. I do believe that they're going to see a big benefit from that, and their panic level will start to decrease.
Chairman.
What I'd like to do is, and given that we've encouraged you to eliminate contractings where you think you could provide enhanced benefits with a full-time employee. Brett, if you would, talk to the governor and make sure that he understood the significance of what was taking place and see whether he had a specific reason for not wanting it or whether it was simply an FTE count and he was opposed to FTE counts.
Mr. Chairman, I believe there were a couple of things going on here in the context of the governor's review of these requests. First of all, I think the employee count was one of his concerns in relation to this request as well as the request in the Guardian ad litem. And secondly, a similar request was approved in the 2011-2012 biennium for a single position here and then four positions in the Guardian ad litem program as well. So his concern, I think, was he wanted to take a break to see if the conversions that occurred in 11 and 12 from the contract to the full-time position were having the desired effect, and he wanted to see a little bit more history and the impact of those conversions in the current biennium before he approved any additional similar conversions.
And that's fair enough. I guess I don't want to just – I mean, typically we would adopt the governor's recs, but in this area, I think we've been kind of driving the discussion towards reducing the outside contract to lawyers where you're paying higher rates, then you're not getting their full time. Plus, they're balancing their private practice with these dollars, and the clients aren't getting the kind of attention. Finally, when we hire full-time employees in the PD's office, you get a level of training that you don't necessarily get to the private folks. Now, with the GAL program, I agree with you, but that was also brand new, and the GAL dollars were not going as far as we wanted, partly because of the rates. So we were trying to push the we put it into Diane's program and then pushed her to hire people in order to control the budget. And so you may actually drive it the other way around. We may end up having to either provide less services or have to pay more to get services out. So, Diane, what you might do is see if you can't, on these areas, catch another meeting with the governor before January, and Brett, maybe just make sure that, I mean, if after considering those considerations you're still there, fine, but I'd kind of like to think about that. Senator Meyer.
Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to get a handle on a couple of things here, so I got a couple of questions, and one, I noticed in these contract things, there was a lot of charges in one particular instance for like $92.59, $104. Is that what I'm trying to figure out, what the average dollar per hour charge our contract people are, whether you have a range or whether it's a maximum or just what it is? And I have a follow-up question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, I think some of those smaller amounts that are in those probably are travel voucher requests, reimbursements for mileage and whatnot. On the public defender side, we pay anywhere from $45 to $50 an hour. However, our public defender attorneys right now get a set amount every month. It's kind of a salary. So, for example, a half-time or a half-caseload contractor works 86.66 hours a month. At $45, that's $3,900 a month. And so you'll see on the public – on those, you'll see consistently $3,900, $4,333, and I can't remember off the top of my head the other amounts. The guardian ad litem attorneys right now make $70 an hour.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I just do the simple math on one FTE at $202,516, and I assume they work a 40-hour week, that's 2,000 hours. The cost per hour is $101.26. It's 2,000 hours too little? That's 40 hours a week for 50 weeks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Meyer, I'm not sure exactly maybe what you're asking, but to me, well, it depends on what kind of what the work actually is and what it would entail, what kind of the case. That probably, in my mind, seems a little low.
2,000 hours, 40 hours a week, that's a standard work week, I guess.
Okay.
So,
right.
You know, 5/8. Do your in-house attorneys work more than 8 hours a day, 5 days a week?
Mr. Chair, Senator Meyer, I think sometimes they do.
Okay.
And on the public defender side, for instance, we contract with the attorneys to pay them for a caseload. So in Laramie County, a half a caseload, let's say, would be, I think right now half a caseload is about 65 open cases. and it could be misdemeanors and felonies or one or the other. And so they get that amount no matter what, however many hours they work. On the guardian ad litem side, I think right now we're averaging about 11 hours a year on a case. 16 hours a year on a case. So I don't know if that helps answer your question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to figure out whether it's better to have contract people at $45 to $50 an hour or an in-house person at $101 an hour. Travel expenses are going to be the same because they're going to be coming out of the either you're either going to pay them by vouchers or you're going to incur them in-house to an internal fund.
Right.
So that's a wash. You're going to have office expenses where the costs associated with the office is in that 45 to 50. So I'm just trying to figure it out why we need to pay twice as much and we.
Okay. I think I understand now, Mr. Chair. If I could maybe clarify. Okay. Well, and I probably wasn't listening very
well. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to come to the agency's rescue, but I think, rather than looking at this as 2,080 hours, you need to look at it as 4,160 hours because it's a biennial amount.
Well, and I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand what you were asking. I think I might have made it worse for you. So.
It's a complicated issue. I mean, from on the outside looking at these services rendered, we were seeing, for example, the GAL program, part of the problem was that GALs in one community were billing fairly strong number of hours mm-hmm. for cases. And then we were getting complaints from the litigants, so that if the mother and the father each have an attorney, and then you're paying the GAL, and all of a sudden everybody's costs double because the GAL is pushing a whole bunch of work, and somebody's just writing the GAL check. The GALs, the more they work, the more the money they get. There's nobody monitoring the budget, and all of a sudden mother and father now have their own fees have just doubled. And we know that in the PD system, the public defender system, that generally doesn't happen. PDs understand they've got a workload. They understand there's no financial benefit for them to drive a case up. So there was a real reason to push that kind of professionalism onto the GAL system. Then when you begin to do hourly billing, if you don't like your hourly rate at 75, you just make sure every time you think about the case, whether you're in the shower or elsewhere, you're billing for it, and you can pick up on hours. So what we're trying to do is say, look, we have a population out there that needs GAL work. How do we best serve them, and how do we stretch our dollars? And I lived under the PD system when it was entirely contracted, and after when there were professional full-time PDs, and you'd have a hard time arguing that the new service is not better. Having professional PDs, that's all they do, delivers better service to that constituency, and that's what we wanted. That's why we brought the GAL on system in there. So, at $40-$45 an hour, you can't run a law office on $40-$45 an hour. But there are folks that said, look, if you give me $3,000 a month, I'll meet your caseload. And it might be that 1 week it's 100 hours. They may not go 2 weeks. But you can go to PD's office where they're on contracts, and you can see the PD client sitting in a chair waiting for 3 or 4 hours to go see an attorney while the private clients come in and out, and then the PD client gets seen after 2 hours wait. Because the private lawyer's got to run his office first, and this is just sort of the overhead that covers it. So once again, if you have the opportunity to shift your dollars to somebody that is all they're doing, you're going to get better service.
Ms. Lozano, you said something, I need a little clarification here, about increasing. It only increases by a quarter, an FTE, and so we're putting a full-time person in there now. So how do you get that it's only increasing by a quarter FTE?
Mr. Chair and Senator Van Flattern, what we would be doing is they have three quarter-time contractors there. There's three of them. We'd be eliminating one of those contracts, but it's only three quarters. So that's the money from that contract that we'd move into the 100 series. But we'd want to add and make that a full-time employee, so we'd have to borrow a quarter FTE there. So when I count FTE for the field offices, I include the percentage of the caseload that the contractors are working.
Oh, that's how. Okay, I see that.
That's what I hear. And Mr. Chair, this capital case funding is a one-time project that I believe that we've asked for the last four or five budgets. This money is just for capital cases. What we've asked for is consistent with what we've asked for in the past, and it's $300,000 for the budget year.
How much did you use in your last fund, and what's your balance going to be, assuming nothing untold between now and the end?
Right. Mr. Chair, well, first of all, in budget year 2009 and 10, we only spent about $141,000 of that and reverted the remaining amount. We did have one capital case that had, you know, started in one fiscal year and ended in another fiscal year, so that was that. Right now, I don't know that we spent any of the money. We also got a $200,000 supplemental budget for that. But we do have two cases right now that we're treating them as capital cases. One out of Laramie County, the district attorney from Natrona County has that case, and he has said that that's likely a capital case. So we're going to have expenses from that case. That's going to include a mitigation investigation that may lead us to Guatemala. So the cost in that case could take up $200,000 to $300,000, would be my best guess. We have another case in Platte County that very likely could be a capital case. We won't know if that's a capital case until probably February or March. We'll have the decision on the case in Laramie County. It's December 19th, right, Ryan? 23rd. December
23rd. Are you the gatekeeper on who gets, you know, what experts to get, or how do you go about deciding what's a reasonable expense for expert mitigation and witnesses, that sort of thing?
Mr. Chair, I am generally the gatekeeper on that. On most cost requests that our attorneys make for other experts, they submit their requests to the deputy, Ryan Roden. The capital cases, we all sort of get together as a team and look at them. I've received a lot of specialized training in capital cases. For instance, I'm on the faculty of a college, a week-long college at the University of Santa Clara every year that helps with mitigation. And so based on that experience, I can tell them what the ABA guidelines require. We have connections now within the capital case, the capital community, so we know where we can get, the best bang for our buck, so to speak. We've had some good luck. Even though I believe that you have to do everything you can in a capital case, I also understand that that's not an open check either. We monitor them. We've gone back at experts and said, you've billed too much. Let's try it this way. Let's try it that way. We tried to do it incrementally. So first is just to look at the case to consult, and then maybe to do an assessment. That's a whole other process that they have to go through. And then if there has to be testimony, we make them go through that same process again. The next item then on page 13, which is listed as priority four. Number four is our IT hardware and software. It's our generally our exceptions request to replace our computers, to renew our subscriptions to our licenses and user licenses. This year we would also like to add providing web cameras to our supervisors. We have two supervisor meetings a year. Probably I need to have more contact with the supervisors for our 14 field offices. So we'd like to be able to have more meetings with them without the travel cost, of course. We also require our supervisors to rely pretty heavily on that database system that I referred to, or the case management system. They're the ones in charge of assigning cases, and I expect them to be on top of how many cases their attorneys have and whatnot. So we would like to provide for them cell phones or, with a data package that could enable them to check those things. Several of our supervisors are on the road quite a bit. They supervise more than one county. They all carry full caseloads. So those are things that we would like to add. I think it would definitely make it more efficient and better and more cost-effective, I think, in how we allocate our cases. And that was recommended by the governor based on the standardized pricing of the replacement for computers, laptops, and printers. The next item on page 14, Mr. Chair, is priority number 5. We had requested an hourly increase for the public defender contract attorneys. Essentially, that request was made to try to, in a way, even out what we pay hourly to the guardian ad litem attorneys. Also, our public defender attorneys, we have some really good attorneys that I'd like to keep. We've lost some contract attorneys, for various reasons. They went on to bigger and better things, maybe, or they didn't. Or I made that decision for them. And we are having a hard time, though, getting some people to come in to take those contracts. And when I explain it to them the way I explained it to you, it's sort of the set amount, the way Mr. Chair described it. That's not always the selling point. All they hear is $45 an hour. So we kind of wanted to add that to that. I think that the governor's recommendation is one that we can live with, however, and he denied that recommendation or that request. No, we were just going to add $5 an hour. So 45. We pay $45 an hour, $47.50 an hour, $50 an hour. So we were just going to add 5 to those amounts. Priority number 6 on page 15, Mr. Chair, we requested to purchase 2 agents' vehicles just assigned to the agency, one for Lander and one for Gillette. The governor recommended that we get 1 vehicle and not the other, and it's likely that we would put that vehicle in Lander if we were given the funding for that. Priority number 7, Mr. Chair, also on that same page is before we submit, right as we were submitting our budget request to the budget office, we were informed that Motor Pool was increasing the rate that you have to pay to keep those assigned vehicles for maintenance and depreciation and those types of things. I believe after that, there was some more study done on what actually that increased cost would be, so the governor recommended $5,000 instead of that $19,000, but we're satisfied, of course, with that funding and that recommendation. And then on to page 23, Mr. Chair, it's actually listed as priority number 2. And just to reiterate, that was a request for 3 full-time attorneys. We were not asking for additional funding. We would take money from the 900 series and decrease again our number of contract attorneys into full-time attorneys in the Guardian Ad Litem program. And we'll have that meeting with the governor and see where we end up on that.
When you have that discussion, I'd like you to talk about the impact on litigants, and that is the now that we're providing these services, having a GAL can dramatically affect the cost of the private litigants. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can give an assessment as to whether or not maybe go out to your population and maybe compare the cost of a divorce taking place in one community versus the other and see whether or not the hourly rate of pay seems to be an inducement to force the other litigants to have additional dollars. If there's none, that's fine, but if you see that there's a trend there, you might tell us and the governor about that.
Okay. We will, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diane, it seems to be a recurring theme I keep hearing from certain people in Carbon County about the GAL program, and we've spoken in the past as well, but all of the problems do seem to be tied to the lack of having a local person there in Rawlins. And so I guess my question, it was one of these 3 positions you were asking for to locate someone in Carbon County, and how are your efforts progressing? Because I know you'd like to get someone there. We have some challenges there. So if you could answer that, see how we're doing in that regard.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Stewart. You're right. We had some problems in Carbon County. I can tell you that we did get 2 local contract attorneys who are now there. So they are located in Carbon County doing the guardian ad litem work. And, yes, Carbon County is one of the counties that we would consider putting a full-time person. We would have to do some work to find some office space to see if the county would provide office space to us and those kinds of things. But Carbon County. Right now, we're not active in Sweetwater County. If Sweetwater County decides that they want to be active in this program, that could cost us about $500,000 if we were just to pay a rate of at it for the attorneys. So Sweetwater County would be another consideration. And then our three big ones still caseload-wise are Laramie County, Natrona County, and Campbell County. So we would sit back, look at the numbers. But Carbon County is on our list, high on the list for that position if we were to get it. $4.2 million, Mr. Chair. And then the final exceptions request is on page 24. And, Mr. Chair, just briefly, it's the same request for the replacement of computers and renewal of subscriptions for the guardian ad litem employees. And the total amount, again, it was reduced from what we requested based on the standardized pricing that came from the CIO. But the governor recommended that, and we're satisfied with that recommendation.
If we can go back to page 11, okay. I have about three questions on that page. It has to do with Part B revenues. Public Defenders Program receives about 15% of the operating from each of the counties. Is any of that in kind, or is all that an actual cash?
Mr. Chair, I believe that it's cash. There's a formula that our fiscal officer and he uses, and then he bills them on an annual or a fiscal basis.
Okay, thank you. And then the decline in the reimbursements, or its fluctuation, I'd say, that goes up one year, down the next, is that tied directly to anything or just caseload, or how is that?
Mr. Chairman, you know, Senator, I'm not exactly sure what the explanation for that is. The courts are required to order reimbursement of public defender fees at the beginning of the case. The judges in the state of Wyoming decided to do that at the end of the case. They also have to make a finding whether or not the defendant has the ability to pay. Just my best guess would be that the clients that we're representing are probably less able to pay that. We are working, I would tell this committee, that we are working on coming up with a fee schedule and some standards of indigency and the like that might even those out. We're working with the Supreme Court on that, and hopefully at the beginning of this year we have something.
Okay, and one more question, Mr. Chairman. It has to that paragraph right above it where it talks about the collection, the reimbursements.
Uh-huh.
But the last sentence says these funds are not available for spending by the Public Defender's Office. Which funds are they referencing? Are they referencing the reimbursement funds below, but you're not allowed to use them? Is that how I understand that?
Mr. Chair, yes, Mr. Senator. The Public Defender Act specifically states that any monies that are paid for reimbursement of public defender fees go back into the general fund. So, I mean, I guess in theory, we are generally funded. Some of that would come back to the public defender's office, but not specifically. It doesn't go into our coffers. It goes into the general fund for use by the state for whatever is generally funded.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the confusing aspect of that is that it says about third sentence that the judge shall determine whether the person is able to pay any funds towards payment of part or all associated with the individual's legal representation, but yet the fund, so that's how he determines it, but the funds go into the general fund.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's been in the Public Defender Act, I think, since 1978. So,
we're fully funding the representation, so right. We wouldn't want to give the office more money to spend. We want our money back.
or reduce,
they're reimbursing us.
or reduce our general fund money to them in lieu of this. Yeah, it just seems to make
right.
more sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As requested, we did offer proposals for a 2%, 5%, and 8% reduction of the standard budget. Generally, to summarize, we decided that looking at past expenditures and then projections of what this budget year is going to look like, really the only monies that we have that aren't tied to personnel and tied to operation of the agency really is in the 900 series. The 2% reduction would be a total of $426,147. And looking at what we've done with the Guardian Ad Litem program, what we think the spending is, and the same with the public defender side, the proposal is to take $357,000 out of the public defender 900 series and $74,049 from the Guardian Ad Litem program. essentially in the public defender side, the 900 series, those monies would be monies that we have to pay for experts that are constitutionally required. Again, we make our attorneys go through a pretty onerous process when they get an expert. Not only do they have to make sure we have the money, we have the say of how much and who and if they really need that expert. You know, right now projections show that, you know, if we were to lose that $357,000, if our cases stayed exactly where they are today, we'd be okay. I don't know that I necessarily have to turn back or say no on experts. Of course, one thing we don't know on the public defender side is how many cases we're actually going to get. We also don't know what types of cases that we're going to be assigned to handle. For instance, two cases happened this year that have never happened since I have been working for the public defender's office. We got a 50-defendant indictment, a drug indictment out of Natrona County. We were able to handle that pretty much in-house with all of our conflict attorneys and everybody, but it started to cost us a lot of money for discovery. For instance, we had to provide a terabyte hard drive for each attorney so they could get the discovery, those kinds of things. Then Fremont County jumped on board, and we right now have, it just started, a 23 co-defendant case. So if those things were to keep happening, then what we need to spend in the 900 series will fluctuate. You know, if we end up with another capital case or we have several homicides and people aren't mentally stable or we have to do accident reconstruction or those kinds of things, DNA testing can be expensive. You know, those how much money we need depends on those types of things. And I would offer that for all of our budget reductions. They incrementally go up, again, based on projections on what we think we have left in the 900 series at the end of this compared to what we expended last year. You know, ultimately what happens is if we were to lose the full 8%, which is a total of $1,704,589, it means that there could be a chance that a public defender client in a serious case might not get the expert that is constitutionally required. It could mean that, and the guardian ad litem level, either we have to cut back on the hourly rate or we have to say, hey, we can't handle any more cases. We do have case limits for the guardian ad litems, and it's based on national standards and best practices. A full-time attorney limit is 80 cases, and a child equals a case. So, again, if things were to remain the same, that 8% would start to hurt. It would start to affect our ability to effectively represent the indigent accused. You know, we might not be able to provide best interest representation to some kids. The 5% cost, I would say, is a little less than that. The 2% cost, unless things dramatically change, that's something that I think we could live with. Thank you.
Yes. Okay, to introduce myself, I'm Mary Ellen Young. I am the new executive director for the Wyoming Miners Hospital Board. Can you hear me? Okay. I have a handout for everyone with the information requested and a cover sheet. I am a retired miner. I retired at the end of February after nearly 32 years of mining. I've been on the board since it was formed, except for 1 year when my term ran out. It's a long story, but anyway, I've been involved in the board since it was formed. It's near and dear to my heart. I was chairperson for probably the last 6 years or so and worked closely with Ed Leake until his untimely death in October of last year. So When Mr. Edlieg passed away, I expressed interest in the position to the board, and they hired me on a part-time basis until I retired from the mine at the end of February, and then I started full-time in March. So I've been kind of, you know, I work closely with Ed, but yet you don't ever really know exactly the day-to-day dealings until you're in the middle of it. And I'm learning baptism by fire. We have our program, as I think you're aware of, has been very successful. We've had a lot of advertising costs to try to get the word out, and I can happily say the word is out. Now we need to learn to tighten the reins on the spending. We're finding that we have a lot of leaks in the system as to how things were interpreted or understood. When the rule was first passed, we changed the rule in September of 2009, and it was in that little cover sheet. And excuse my typing in the cover sheet. My computer's in the IT office fighting a virus, and so I got a little notebook that I wasn't familiar typing on. But our rule vaguely stated that you had to work, actually, if you were a miner on the mine site, you were covered for benefits and you were a resident. And in 2009, we did a rule change that said you had to have worked consecutively 12 months on a mine site to be considered, because literally anybody that went out there and picked up garbage could have been eligible for our benefits for a lifetime. So that helped to rein it in a little bit. But to go on to the staffing, you had requested staffing numbers. Our staffing has always been just one. That was Ed Leek. He's always been an AWAC employee. He was employed in 2003. I came on in March 1st, 2011, as a full-time AWAC employee. Between November and March, I was a part-time AWAC employee. In November, we had a board meeting. The board hired me, and they said they wanted better representation for our miners. They requested two offices, one in the Rock Springs area, one in the Gillette area, and they wanted them staffed part-time. So we opened the office in Gillette in April, I believe, of 2011. I had a horrible time finding office space in Rock Springs that was affordable for a part-time person. I finally got one in August of this year in Green River, and we brought a person on in November that works in the afternoons in the Green River office. So I have a part-time AWAC in Gillette that works mornings, a part-time AWAC in Green River that works in the afternoons. Our budget really didn't really change a lot. Even though we've had increased costs, I foresee just from the changes that we have done that we're hoping that we're going to actually reduce our spending and target more of our miners that need the assistance rather than some of the miners that are getting assistance that have insurance that really pick up the bulk of their expenses anyway. In our program, we're only, by statute, we're only allowed to cover four health conditions. It's hearing, respiratory, cardiac, and muscle skeletal. And as we all know, muscle skeletal is a huge platform. Hearing, respiratory, cardiac, and muscle skeletal. We have three different programs. We have a hearing aid program, which was our very first program. Right now, we allot $2,000 for hearing aids for people, and that's its own separate program. It's not really a lifetime benefit, but we only okay a second hearing aid if it's medically necessary. If the audiologist sends me a request and says the hearing has deteriorated to the point that they need another hearing aid, then we do that. I personally would like to be able to increase the amount we offer for hearing aids, but first we have to get our miners' medical assistance costs under control. The other program we have is wellness testing. where we contract with Campbell County Memorial Hospital to cover the Gillette, Buffalo, Sheridan area. We contract with most out of New Jersey to cover the other parts of the state. We haven't found anybody yet who wants to cover the whole state. They bring in vans. Campbell County has a stationary location, but they also do mobile testing. And they give physicals to people who are eligible and would like to have a physical. We've put some... anyway, that's the wellness testing. And then we have the Miners Medical Assistance, which has seen, of course, huge growth because we offer $5,000 a year to help offset their medical expenses, their out-of-pocket medical expenses for one of those four health, any of those four health conditions. That's the one that we're really challenged by because I find that we're paying people's deductibles. I find that it doesn't have to be mine related, doesn't have to be work related, or else it'd be workers' comp. That's the section we're really challenged to rein in our costs. And I think we've done quite a bit towards it, but we have more to do. Some of the things that we've already done, like I said, we changed the rule in Chapter 2, the service for minors, that they had to have worked on a mine site for 12 consecutive months. The problem we're having with that now is that we have somebody that will come and cater at the mine site 2 days a month for a year, and they determine themselves eligible for our benefits. That isn't quite it. We just formed a subcommittee at our November meeting to better define minor. And our registration forms are going to be revised where it will ask for person's work location, their employer, their work location, their work title. Because right now we contract with EBMS. They get a registration form in, and it says Mary Young works for Peabody Energy. Fine, but I may work in an office in town and never step foot on a mine site. I'm not technically a miner, but they don't know that. So that's a real challenge. I met with EBMS this morning, and we're really going to tighten the reins on that. In 2010, we did another rule change, and I don't have the exact date here, but we had one chiropractor in Rock Springs that was submitting extremely high charges. In fact, as far as providers that we were paying out to, we also pay for prescription drugs. He was number two on the list of, $162,000 a year. We were paying one chiropractor in Rock Springs. So the board decided to put a cap on chiropractic charges and expenses of what we would pay, and we did a rule change, and we said we'll pay $50 per visit, maximum 21 visits per year annually. So we've seen a great reduction in the cost from that chiropractor, actually from all of them. Just October of this year, we did another rule change, and our rules, we could not reimburse minors directly for any out-of-pocket expenses. When I started looking at auditing some of the expenses, the first thing I saw was we were paying prescriptions, we were reimbursing active employees that I was working with anywhere from $150 to $800 for a prescription. And when I called EBMS, I said, what's going on here? And they said, well, you're primary payer on prescriptions. And I said, no, we're not. And they said, yeah, you are. That's how we've been paying it for 2 years. I said, no, we're not. So it was a miscommunication. She said, they said this is what Ed told them. Ed's not here to defend himself, so I don't really know. It was a miscommunication. Plus, we had some pharmacies that wouldn't bill secondary. So if a person walked up and said, I'm registered with the Wyoming Miners, they said, oh, okay, we'll just bill them 100%. So we did another rule change, and we said we want to be able to reimburse minors for out-of-pocket expenses for prescriptions only. So that forces the minor, if they have insurance, they file it with their primary insurance. If they then want reimbursed for that $10, $20, or whatever for their out-of-pocket expense, they submit a claim to EBMS with their documentation. EBMS then cuts the check to them. In the last, we were running between 45% and 50% of our minors' medical assistance was prescription drugs. The last 2 months, we've dropped down to 9% and 11%. So it's made a drastic change. We do have a hardship division, because I know we do have a lot of retired people out there, limited income, maybe living off Medicare, Social Security. All they have to do is write me a letter. They usually will provide documentation from their pharmacist of their list of drugs that they're on every year. It gives me a monthly expense of what their drug expenses are, and we will issue them a hardship card so that they can present it to the pharmacist so they don't have to cough up the sometimes $500-$800 for their prescriptions a month. They just don't have that much money and then wait for reimbursement. So we'll go ahead and give them a hardship. We'll pay for their drugs up front, but that card has to be renewed every year. It could be somebody that's disabled right now, and in a year from now, they may have a job with insurance. So if they want to stay on the hardship, they have to renew it every year. If they're disabled and retired, it's not going to change. But in October, we also asked all the minors to re-register. EBMS did that for us. They sent out mailings to re-register and explain the changes in the prescription drugs. We verified their information, and they had to provide their insurance information because we had nothing on file. So it makes EBMS stop before they pay a claim and make sure that they've submitted it to their primary insurance. Of course, they asked for the EOB first. They also, all the minors now have a registration card, which they never had before. And it's a yellow and black registration card that gives billing information. So if they have to go out of state or actually to any doctor, they can show them this card and say, this is my secondary insurance, even though we're not in insurance, we're a benefit. And the service provider knows who to bill after all the other insurance is paid. And it says specifically on the card, we are last payer. So whether they have Medicare and a supplemental, we're last payer. Also, for wellness testing, when the service provider does wellness testing, they submit a bill to us, that minor that they tested has to have a registration number. We were finding out that they were testing people maybe that weren't really eligible or weren't registered. We also made it a rule, and actually it was in our rule anyway, it just wasn't being followed. There's no retroactive payments. So if you broke your leg 2 months ago and you found out about us today and you came in and registered today, we're not going to go back 2 months ago and pay for that broken leg, which we were doing.
Mr. Chairman, sorry. On wellness benefits, the new Affordable Care Act restricts some of those wellness benefits to once every 5 years, like cholesterol checks and things like that. Is that going to have an impact? Because even though you may have insurance, your insurance says that they're only going to pay for that once every 5 years. So, but the doctor might say you need it every year. So, do you become the first payer in that, or does?
I'm not really familiar with it yet. So we'll have to do some research on that. I know that the subcommittee that was formed, we will be looking into that. And we're having a real issue with the wellness testing anyway, because we're just like, I was employed by Peabody Energy. Peabody Energy pays for their employees to have an annual physical. If you have one, they also then give you a check for $150 for having that annual physical. Then why are we testing them? Why is it even eligible? But yet we can't really know every company's insurance benefits out there. So that's something that we're really gonna look at. We're gonna really look at criteria. I personally have a problem with somebody that's been mining for a couple years and they get drunk and they break their leg and when they're riding their four wheeler, which we've had, and we go and we pay their out of pocket expenses, and that cuts the money out of that retired miner or disabled miner who has long term health consequences because of mining. So we're looking at doing some pretty serious changes to the program.
What's the balance of your trust fund, and what are your revenues and your revenue sources?
We have the Miners Hospital Fund. We're, I guess, a trust fund. And as of December 1st, the combination of the corpus and the income fund and the corpus was $83.7 million. By statute, we can spend 5% of that annually.
The occurring revenue sources to that, you have more money coming in from the federal government that augments that?
We have been up until this last month was the last time we took a dip. We've been sitting September of 10, we had 81.9. We've gone up to 80. It was 84.1 in November 1, and then December 1 is 83.7. It's been growing up until this last month. We never budget the full 5%.
Okay. Does it grow up? Do you have other contributions to the fund? That do you still have a revenue source outside of the trust fund?
No, just the trust fund. But we get revenue off that trust fund. We get minerals and royalties off the land that makes up this trust fund.
Okay. What kind of revenues is that like?
I know we have leases and we have some mineral royalties. That's a question that's always been hard to answer. It's a state land trust fund, and I've read on it several times, and I still have a hard time getting a straight answer exactly. I know that any leasing that's done from the tracts of land goes into our fund. Any mineral royalties, any income at all that's from those, I think it's 30,000 acres, that's tracts of land, go into our fund, plus whatever the investments that come off that fund.
Well, I just wonder about, so you get 5% off that, and when you talk about the sustainability of your revenues, you're based upon the 5% is what's available to you.
That's the maximum we can budget.
And you need to make all your payments within that.
Yes.
I think there were years where you were not spending the 5%. It sounds like now you're having no problem spending the 5%.
We didn't spend it all this year, but we're going to have to do another B11 yet for the Miners Medical Assistance, not for a large amount. We still won't meet our budget, but it's getting close.
When you B11, what do you B11 from what to what?
And you have to excuse me, it goes into the 900 series to the Miners Medical Assistance, and it comes right out of our, we can only spend out of the income fund, we can't spend out of the corpus.
Okay. So with that, when you B11, are you saying that you B11 amount out of your income fund that was in excess of your 5%?
No.
It was within the 5%.
Yes. Yeah.
It was within the 5%, but not budgeted.
Right.
Fair enough. Tell us about the allocations or expenses between Southwest Wyoming and Northeast Wyoming and how you're dealing on those issues. We typically hear about them.
The comparison between the two?
The needs of Southwest and Northeast and advertising, things like that.
We have more miners, more active miners in the Northeast. But our services are provided the same throughout the state. We have hearing aid providers. We have, I think, 20 now preferred hearing aid providers that cover the whole state. And the miner gets to select which one of the preferred providers they want to go to if they want the full $2,000. The wellness testing, I'm trying to think if we have... We tested 741 miners in the southwest part of the state last year, as compared to over 3,000 in the northeast, but that's just a difference in numbers. a number of active minors. We get more retired minors. We have to do more advertising in the south, in the southwest part of the state, because a lot of those minors are not active. They're retired. We advertise at nursing homes, newspapers, radio. We really work hard to try to get to the less populated areas, Grable, Lovell, Guernsey, where they tend to have smaller operations and then tend to have less benefits. We do a lot to try to reach those people. Those are the ones that need our money the most.
I think your first exception request is on page 13, for that's for the AWAC positions, and looks like you had a B11 where you already received those, and
yes,
the governor's recommended approval.
Yep.
It looks like you're only there. He reduced it by $5,000, and that $5,000 reduction had more to do with your IT, it looks like. All right. Anybody have any questions about that? Do you have anything else that you want to talk to us about, Mary Ellen, while you're here? Or anybody have any other questions? Senator Hastert, do you have some questions?
Just out of curiosity, I see that you pay into the Wyoming Mining Association for... Is that two memberships, or
that's one membership?
I just see the $500 per year times two. Is that obviously maybe it's $1,000? What's the reasoning for the involvement or the membership into that?
It was to try to get on their mailing list and some of their events, so that I could reach some of the smaller operations that were within the mining association. Because what I found is, Dear Ed, he was not tech savvy, and I don't have a lot of contact information. So to get information out to a lot of these mining companies that have employees that could use our benefits, or retired miners, whatever, I had nothing to go on, no contact information or anything. So that was the main reason for joining the mining association this year, as whatever their bottom tier membership was. I believe it's an honorary. It's whatever their cheapest. That sounds good. I didn't ask them, but okay.
I think you ought to ask them. These are, you know, these dollars were intended for actual benefits, and the you're helping their members and their employers. But you at least ought to ask them whether you can have a free honorary membership.
Good point. Good point. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Chairman. That was where I was kind of directing it. Also,
okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, just now you're reaching out. You're requiring all the miners to register. And what form are you utilizing to get the information or the word out to all the miners to register, that they need, that they're required to register to get the benefits?
The ones that were already registered, which we had over 4,000 that were already registered, were all sent a letter stating, here's the changes, the prescription changes, the re-registration. And then once they registered, they were given claim forms and stuff. The others has been really word of mouth, but we've let, most of it comes from word of mouth, or the people doing the wellness testing in Campbell County, the people doing most testing. Of course, they're encouraged to have everybody registered, or else we're not going to pay their bill. I haven't been really pushing a lot on the advertising right now, because we need to set some more boundaries first before we do more advertising.
Mr. Chairman, what, and as far as boundaries as to who is eligible?
Yes.
Okay. Now, and as you know, as I think I mentioned to you yesterday, I'm one of the ones that has fallen through the cracks somehow, because I haven't received any, and being a minor for 30-some years. Okay. Now, there was a lot of issues raised. Well, no, I shouldn't say a lot. There were several issues raised about concerns about advertisement or availability in the southeast region of Wyoming. Do you feel that that's been remedied as far as advertisement?
We're addressing that with having an office in Green River, but she's only been there since November 15th. So she's going to be working that area more and doing more advertising.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I was speaking more of this area here in southeast Wyoming.
Oh, okay.
There was issues raised by some individuals about concerns about not being able to access and wondering and finding out what was the eligibility. I just wanted to know if you're doing more advertising in other areas around the state. And I know principally the miners are in it, but we have sporadic miners in a few locations around the state, like southeast Wyoming.
Well, actually, we did have a glitch this last time I know when we did some wellness testing in Guernsey that it was not advertised in that area, and that was an oversight from someone from my office. So it's something that we are going to address, the more the advertising in the typically not mining areas too.
Mr. Chairman, and I've had several individuals, and I think I know that you address some of these things, but I just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on, miners that have worked in the mines of Wyoming their entire career, but have moved out of the state, and currently they're not eligible for any benefits.
That's true.
And is that something the board is looking into or trying to decide if?
We discussed it at our board meeting in November. So far, the board is pretty staunch still that they need to be a resident currently. I'm the one that takes the phone calls from the people that have worked for 28 years and relocated out of state due to health, due to family or whatever, and I have a real hard time denying them benefits when I know that I have people that their primary address is in South Dakota, North Dakota, Colorado, but yet they're considering themselves a resident because they're living and working here for over a year. That's a huge bone of contention with me, and it's something that we're going to work on to try to address.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if the Constitution, the language there helps you or directs you at all.
It does. The statute says they have to be a current resident. They had to have been a resident while they were working here, and they have to be a current resident to get benefits.
Okay. And then I know the Mr. Chairman, the other issue is still, I know in your area, which is in the northeast part of Wyoming, we have miners that are residents of the state of Wyoming and then are working actually in the state of Montana.
Yep.
And how is that?
That's worded specifically in our statute that we cover them.
Okay, so that's still?
That's the way it is right now, today.
Being a resident of the state and working in a mine.
In a contiguous state. You can be a resident of Wyoming but work across the border. But when they set up the statute, they never thought about the opposite either. Because we have a lot of people, especially with the economic times, we have a lot of miners now that primary address is not Wyoming, but they live here while they're working here, and according to our statute, all they have to do is show a utility bill.
Mr. Chairman, maybe it's a direction here on what would the Constitution be take supremacy over a statute, or can a statute modify, the statute can't modify the Constitution, so the Constitution language would be what would be intact. Is that not correct?
The Constitution would be the guiding document, and the statute would implement it. But if the Constitution is silent, the statute could interpret it.
Thank you. All I have for right now. Thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Mr. Chairman. I want to follow up a little bit about, I don't really want to use the word neglect, but the southeast part of Wyoming, just looking at your mobile wellness testing program, Cheyenne's not even on this list, and I guess there are quite a few retired miners that do live in the southeast portion of the state,
Isn't it possible to get that wellness van in the Cheyenne area?
It absolutely is. In fact, I'm working on the 2012 schedule right now.
Okay, that's great. Mr. Chairman, follow up. Now, this $5,000 benefit, the prescription part of it, okay, you said on the card it says that it's not to be considered it's going to be considered the last resource of payment?
Yes.
If that's their only prescription benefit they have, are we having any problems with pharmacies fulfilling those prescriptions? You had any complaints about that at all?
No, but we've only had the new system in effect for 2 months.
2 months?
And I can see from the bills that some of them, we are the primary payer on the prescription.
And
we only have 8 hardships right now that have been requested. But yet we have people out there that don't have prescription coverage, but they're able to pay for the prescription and then ask for reimbursement. Some people financially are not able to do that, and they ask for a hardship.
Here, Mr. Chairman, this quarry that we have out here at Granite, is that considered a mine? Are those guys working at those quarries considered miners?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not real sure how many employees we have out there. So someone that's worked at the Granite Quarry and they've now are retired, they just show you proof that they've worked there a consecutive 12 months, resident of the state of Wyoming, get these 4 basic benefits in the hearing, respiratory, cardiac, and muscle skeletal. What did you provide prior to changing your chiropractic benefit? It shows you had 41 visits that they year.
We changed it to 21. It was unlimited.
It was unlimited.
It was unlimited.
Oh,
an unlimited dollar amount. We had some chiropractors would, of course, want to do all the X-rays and a lot of your insurances won't pay. They'll pay maybe 50% on adjustments. Well, if they worded it where the insurance, where it was worded as adjustment, maybe the insurance only pick up 50%. We would pick up the remainder. We were getting hit pretty hard on it.
Mr. Chairman, why did you come up with the 21 visits? Was that just a number you picked out of the air, or is that what?
It had something to do with the guidelines on workers' comp.
You got that from workers' comp?
Yes. Okay.
That's all I have for now, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you. Yep, thank you.
And that's